The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. A number of programs ago, we began a series in which we have been looking at gaps, spaces. We started out discussing the problem of a gap between nothing and something. And over actually several months, we have followed a discussion involving all of those kinds of difficulties that face the evolutionist, an individual who is attempting to explain all that we see in nature on the basis of matter rearranging itself over a period of millions and billions of years. I think I recall a promise I had made that I would not turn these programs into a detailed class on invertebrate organisms or whatever. And I'm afraid as a teacher, this is my inclination. These organisms to me are so interesting and so diverse and have such very different characters that I am fascinated by the sorts of things that we find. I would suspect probably that some of you who listened are not as enthusiastic about that as I am. And it has occurred to me that perhaps we have delved too far into this kind of thing, and I will do my best to reform if that is an area of difficulty. We've gotten down to the organisms that are known as pseudocoelomates. Pseudo, of course, simply means false. Coelom, C-O-E-L-O-M, is a body cavity. So these organisms are organisms that have a false body cavity. Now, we introduced these, I think, two programs ago. We talked a little bit about the types, about a number of things. The pseudo business has to do simply with the fact that the body cavity, the cavity of the organism that holds all of the internal organs, in these organisms does not have a mesodermal lining. Now, there are three primary germ layers, ectoderm, endoderm, mesoderm. And we talked about those, have talked about them before. But this is simply the basic characteristic for the organisms known as coelomates. I think when we began this, I had indicated to you that there are actually nine phyla of organisms that are here. Most of these, even some zoologists, are not aware of. And I certainly do not want to take time discoursing on things that are of little consequence or of little interest. But there is one group of the pseudocoelomates, namely the nematodes, that is of some interest and some importance. When we first started talking about organisms, I indicated that there were essentially five reasons that we would consider a particular group of organisms to be of importance. One of these is simply the number. If there are great numbers of organisms, then by itself, in itself, that becomes of some importance. There are some groups of organisms that are of importance by virtue of the things that they destroy. They destroy crops or other things that humans are interested in. So some of them are of importance for that reason. Some of them cause diseases, the pathogens, and worldwide and over the course of history, billions of people have died because of this, and others will in the future, as we've discussed. Some of them are parasites. They don't cause diseases, but they simply inhabit human beings or other organisms. And in some cases, they're used for food. Now, the nematodes would fit the category of those which cause diseases and are parasites. I guess not diseases exactly, but there are many very, very important human parasites that are found in this particular phylum. The word nematoda comes from a Greek word that means thread, and many of them are very tiny. Probably the bulk of them are 10 millimeters or less. If you're not sure of how much a millimeter is, why, find yourself a plastic ruler sometime and look at a single millimeter. And you recognize then that many of these organisms are quite small. Some of them are fairly long. We'll talk briefly about one, the human roundworm, that gets to be maybe a foot in length or more. But they vary tremendously in size. As far as numbers are concerned, you will see varying figures. I think probably a good working figure for the number of species of nematodes or roundworms is about 12,000. I think I mentioned earlier Asa Chandler's definition of a worm. There are lots of organisms that, to the layman, would fall into that category, and Chandler's definition is pertinent. He said anything that is round and long and not obviously something else is a worm. So we have things like earthworms, for example, or actually there are some mollusks that look like worms. The flatworms that we've talked about, the roundworms that we're talking about now. So the term worm is not a very descriptive term at all. We are looking here then, or talking here, about those organisms that are found in the phylum Nematoda, the roundworms. They are as varied as almost anything you want to talk about. Some of them are free living. They are not parasitic. They simply exist in nature. And they feed on all kinds of things, bacteria, yeast, fungi, algae. Many of them are parasitic. And it is these parasites that I would like for us to turn our thoughts to. And the reason for taking this time is that these organisms have some unique characteristics different from anything else. I hope those of you that listen regularly will bear in mind that we are dealing basically with the problems of how these organisms, on this program in particular, the nematodes, could have evolved. If the evolutionists are correct, then there should be a relationship between all living things. And yet we're looking here at some organisms which are so different, so unusual, that there is certainly nothing else in nature that could be used as an ancestor for the nematodes. Now, it occurred to me as we were doing the taping that if there are evolutionists that are listening here, their immediate response is, oh, we're not arguing that nematodes, roundworms, have evolved from other organisms in nature today. We argue that these roundworms have come from a common ancestor of some kind. Now, we talked about this a long time ago, but it might be well to remind some of you that may have started listening since then about this idea. If the evolutionists do not expect the roundworms to be related to any other organisms that we find in nature today, what is their explanation, their attempt to explain where these things have come from? And this, of necessity, involves what have been known as phylogenetic trees. Phylogenesis, or phylogenetic, is simply a synonym for evolution. And these, then, are simply evolutionary trees. If you have picked up any current biology textbook, at least on a beginning level, you will have seen some of these trees there. They start off with an organism down at the base, and then you see the trunk and the branches as they move up away from that origin. And out at the end of each of these branches, you will find individual organisms that are listed there. And the evolutionist argument then would be these organisms that are put out on the exterior, the periphery of these trees, are simply connected to common ancestors that are found down at the branching on the interior of the phylogenetic trees. We spent a fair amount of time talking about these before, and I don't want to do that again, but I do want to make a couple of comments. I would urge people, when they look at these phylogenetic trees, to understand that what they're looking at is a tree composed only of leaves. The leaves, the organisms on the outside of the tree, are in fact those things that are known. These are the things that we can find in nature. Now, their relationship with those imaginary common ancestors or intermediate species or missing links that compose the trunks and branches of the tree are simply speculative. They are mental constructs. They really do not ever exist. And this is at the root of the difficulty of the evolutionary approach to these things. Now, for a layman, these trees sometimes be very impressive if you don't understand what I have just said to you. Every time you come to a branch in that imaginary structure, there ought to be a common ancestor or an intermediate species or what are properly known as missing links found at that point. Now, I have used those three terms together twice recently, a few moments ago. Common ancestor, intermediate species, missing link. Why would I use them together? Well, the answer simply is that they're all the same thing. The common ancestors are also the intermediate species that are also the missing links. Missing links mean simply they have not been found. Now, we talked briefly a long time ago about Darwin's answer to the problem of the missing links, and it is a major difficulty for evolution. And his argument at the time, of course, was simply that the fossil record was not complete, and that this was the reason for those things that were missing. And in Darwin's day, that was a legitimate answer. But the fact is, since Darwin's day, there has been extremely extensive collection of fossils all over the world. And although in the 1800s, the response that the fossil record was incomplete was a legitimate one, it is not so now. And the interesting thing is that the things that were missing in Darwin's day are still missing today, and the gaps between them are getting wider. I think I will wait until next program and give an illustration that may be helpful to some of you to give some kind of a foundation for the point that I'm trying to make. Since it is so critical, since from an evolutionary standpoint, that has to be the basis of trying to form a relationship between one organism and another, or between all of the organisms, it is worth understanding why the reasoning that underlies it is so faulty. And it is faulty. Again, I would remind you basically that this is the Bible and modern science, and we're trying to link those things that we can observe in nature, which is the essence of science, to connect those with what we're able to read about in Scripture itself. So we find these two views, creation and evolution, and they are opposing one another. In my opinion, they are not harmonizable. We spent some time discussing theistic evolution not long ago. So we see these two views, and it is my hope that those of you who are Bible believers will acquire a basis of being able to understand for yourself why evolution simply is not a defensible subject from the standpoint of science.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson@bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.